So this will be the third talk on this topic. And in the article, they come down to the point where they do a research survey on how people feel in relationships and then in addressing things with colleagues. And what were some of the strategies that the people use, people who, in conversational processes use to have healthy relationships or to have beneficial, useful, positive outcome relationships. And the first one is we touched on it a little bit last week on this idea of safeness, and which is where I offered the practice for the week, which is to downregulate, because that's part of it, right? The internal distress tolerance, the higher that is, or the lower our tolerance for internal distress, the higher the internal distress, the lower our tolerance for it, causes all kinds of fight, flight, freeze responses, right? If I don't feel secure, if I'm not secure in my own stand, in my own ground, and I don't mean that as a rigidity, but that as a solid space under my feet, you know, metaphorical or otherwise, my body is going to take over and send signals, or going to interpret that and send signals of a lack of safety, a lack of space to be able to maneuver should I need to, right? Paul Gilbert talks about a concept called safeness, which is different from safety, right? And as I understand it, safety is the everyday stuff, you know, it's the seat belt. It's the concrete structural stuff where we feel we have space in a room, we're near the door, or we, you know, we feel we can walk across the room to leave the room, to leave the site. So it's the connotation in it is one of a physical spacing that allows me to experience what I'm experiencing and then to find my way out. If I don't feel like I'm protected in any way, or that I can protect myself, and there are two things there. One is, you know, are there others around me who will protect me? And the other is, can I protect myself? Most of the challenges in conflictual conversations or contentious conversations, when I work with my clients, the first thing that they say is, I thought someone had my back. How many times have you gone to a meeting or you've been in a conversation where we assume, rightfully so, that our colleagues, our family, someone will stand beside us, you know, watch over us, and intervene if necessary. You know, the concept of taking my side is a really important one, right? And when you think of it structurally, even physically, for someone to take my side is for someone to be beside me. And how often have we felt that as a betrayal when we thought we could count on someone and, you know, they, for their own reasons, were unable to be beside us? Ironically, probably because they didn't feel that there was someone beside them. And you can see this as, you know, cascading to a whole series of people in a room who just don't feel safe because they don't know who's beside whom, right? But let's be narcissistic in a healthy way for a moment and just think about ourselves in that space, right? And think about the times when we really felt that we could risk because there'd be someone to back us up. There'd be someone to say, yes, you know, I vote for, you know, I vote with, right? Or, hey, everybody back up. You know, so and so has a good point. Lynette has a point. Let's hear it. So that sense of safety and is dependent on our safeness. How much do I feel within myself that should I find myself alone in this battle in this room with a whole lot of other people, metaphorically or otherwise, that I can protect myself. And protect is a very large word, but the connotation in that is, what can I do that allows me to feel that even if I'm standing alone, I'm solidly standing alone. This is really, really hard because we're not biologically trained, biologically given to stand alone. Being alone is the peak of vulnerability. And you've all shared stories where you have found yourselves alone. Certainly I have. You know, the anecdote I shared last week about, you know, going up against the prof and wasn't intending to going up against him, but doing it because I felt I was a spokesperson for everybody behind, literally behind me, and then finding out that, oops, they all took a step back, right? And there I was, all alone, and screwed for the remainder of my PhD on any research assistant. Stuff like that happens, metaphorically or truly, like physically, truly, right? So the lesson in all of this is, yes, we do need people beside us, behind us, watching our back, hearing us, supporting us, you know, carrying us out of the battle when we need to be carried out, right? Waiting till we heal. We need people like that in our lives. We can't do it alone. We can't do it in isolation, right? So how do we then, if we want to create safety in a conversation, you know, and the example that they give, which I'm not sure I buy into, is that if you're in a contentious, you know, conversation and emotions escalate, it's up to you to reassure the other person of your respect and how you value their opinion. And I do buy that piece. But it's not that easy to reassure someone else when you're upregulated, when I'm upregulated. Okay, let's make this, include me in this circle. So this is really important. Confidence in meeting someone who may not share your views, share our views, requires keeping a finger on the pulse of our own internal distress and the degree to which it starts to escalate. If it escalates, it doesn't mean we're not good at this. It's going to escalate because it's meant as a safety factor. So in that moment, reassuring someone else that you respect them, even though you may, is not within our reach. I wish it were, you know, I wish I could kind of go, oh, you know, I'm now absolutely terrified that something I value very much is going to be lost. Let me just put that on the shelf while I reassure you that I'm not out to get you. If you can do that, please let me know, because I really want to learn. I don't think that it can happen that way. I think it can happen, but I don't think it can happen that way. So the practice then has to be noticing how I'm starting to ramp up and start with that sense of safeness that says, what skills have I got to downregulate? And I have them because, you know, I've been going through the whole day doing these doorknob meditations and coming back to my breath and dropping into my feet and all of that, right? I do have them. I mean, while I you know, I may poke a little bit of fun at those practices, they are crucial. Absolutely crucial. But there's also some physical stuff that we can do. So when we're in this relationship where we feel that whatever we're hearing, whatever we're seeing, whatever we're evaluating in the interchange is starting to trigger a protective response, which is what that internal distress is, right? It's not, yes, it's distress, but it's also a signal that we're not feeling safe in the connection. I now have to take responsibility for that. And I have to start to use my practices as best I can in the moment to address that distress. Now here's the key. it may not be that I can reduce the distress because that's multifactorial, inner and outer, but it is necessary that I sit in the presence of it and not add another layer of distress to it. Why am I feeling this way? I shouldn't be feeling this way. There's the key to being in the presence of, or being in the relationship of a difficult situation. Because what happens? I'm in a difficult situation. I've got to address someone who is probably going to feel very, some antipathy towards me because of what I'm about to tell them. I'm already anxious. It's starting to trigger. I don't like feeling anxious, so my voice is going to get higher. I'm actually not trying to speak over them. I'm trying to speak over my own fear, right? So I start escalating, I become overly direct. This clear tension in my voice, which of course all it's doing is triggering the other person. But more than that, I've lost fact. I've lost the script. Right? I've lost the storyline, which is, I'm going to feel discomfort, and it's okay. I'm not losing the argument because I'm feeling discomfort. Because, none of us likes to lose the argument. I don't know about you, but I sure as heck do not like losing arguments, right? But it's difficult to say, I'm feeling upregulated, but it doesn't mean I'm going to lose this because there's no winning and losing here. And I have to attend to, am I reacting? Am I amplifying my reaction because this really is part of the conversation, or is it because I'm afraid of what's going on inside me? So in a relationship, that's a really key part. This internal distress tolerance is a really key part to being steady, and it means being steady with the discomfort I feel inside. Because some conversations are very challenging. They're incredibly challenging. The conversations of identity, the conversations of our right to be who we are, the conversations of our right to hold views that we hold. And it all comes down to that internal safeness. A huge component of which is my ability to know that I'm feeling distressed, but not allowing it. So that's the challenge in this whole idea of confidence in speaking up, confidence in being in the presence of emotions that are escalating. It starts with being confident and being secure when our own emotions are escalating internally. There's no way of being comfortable with someone else's escalation until I am comfortable with my own escalation. So often, I find myself trying to shut down the other person because I'm amping up too quickly. It happens in therapy. And it's interesting, of course, as soon as when we were face to face, it was far more intense. As soon as the person starts to express very, very deep and hurt emotions and the pain and sorrow of what they're going through, I find myself leaning forward, not to be in connection, but leaning forward in order to downregulate them. And it's so counterintuitive to lean back and to just drop into my breathing. Not just, but to drop into my breathing, to downregulate myself. And interestingly, they come into line with that. Because there's only so long we can keep upregulating before we crash, right? But if I start stoking that fire, it's going to upregulate for the remainder of the session and more. Right? And it's the same with family. It's the same with friends. It's the same with every other human being on this in this universe, right? If I enter that upregulation as a means of trying to downregulate myself, I'm just adding fuel to the fire. So why is practice important? It's important exactly for that. It's important not to suppress what we're feeling. And I want to be really clear about that. Being in the presence of my own internal distress is not about suppressing it or forcing it to downregulate, but not allowing it to have full control. If the conversation is such that I can even speak to it, I might want to indicate that as the person is speaking, this is what I'm feeling. Not because I want them to take charge of it, but because my hope is that I communicate a resonance with them. We're both hurting in this. We're both feeling uncomfortable. So it's really important then to see how these continuous downregulations, that practice of continuous downregulations, plays a huge role in creating a sense, a container within which we feel safe within ourselves. This is the other part, we cannot make someone else feel safe. There are many ways of being that we have that can be threatening to others, to their concepts, their ideas, their wishes, in relationships that don't work, whether it's a relationship at work, whether it's a family relationship, whether it's friendships. There are many relationships, there are no relationships that work 100%, but there are many relationships that simply no longer work because of our growth or their growth, right? So it's important that we continually cultivate that sense of this tolerance for loss, because loss happens. The internal distress, which is really a fear of losing somebody. It's really not about losing the argument, it's about losing somebody. And to continue to be in the presence of that, as painful as it may be at times, to be in the presence of that and, not wanting it to be different. Not wanting it to be different doesn't mean I'm going to sit here and grit my teeth and not do anything about it. But in that moment, what I'm saying to myself is, this is what it is. It's here. It's now. In the next moment, it will be a different here and now and whatever it is that's present. But in this moment, this is what's present. And that's a really hard practice, because when things are painful, when things are challenging, we so want it to be different. Now, I can go back to a billion conversations where I would have done anything for it to have been different. And the interesting is, it does become different. It may not be the difference that I was hoping for, but it does become different. And that's what I'm tracking, is trying to anyway, in a conversation, in a conflict. I'm tracking for that shift. And then here's a really tricky one. As soon as it shifts, I have to leave it alone. My tendency used to be, as soon as it shifts, I want it to then leap in there and leverage it to my advantage. No. You wait for that shift. and you leave it alone. Because that allows the other person to see that things can change and it won't be used against them. It allows us to see things can change and it won't be used against me. I won't use it against me. The other person may, but I won't use it. So this is really challenging. It's really, it's not easy at all. But it comes back down to trust. Just as when, before we started this talk and I was saying, I have this habit of constantly breaking my meditation stream and checking the timer. Well, the very reason I have the timer that I do is so that I can trust, so I can concentrate on what I need to do, and I can trust that time will pass and the ding will happen. So even something as tiny as that is a practice of trust. Trust that you turned on the timer. Trust that it will go off. There's no need to check it. Trust the process, really, is what we're saying. So safety is, and safeness is, dependent on trust. It's not trust in the other, but it's trust in ourselves. And it includes trust that no matter how badly you think you've screwed something up, it will recover. It may not recover in a way that we would want it to, but it will recover to some point, to some equilibrium we might be able. So that safeness is dependent on trust. Cultivate that trust and cultivate it over the week with very ordinary things. I don't know if you heard the clock, our clock bell bird going off, right? And I'm supposed to learn which bird calls these are, and they all sound like a blue jay to me, right? So, trust that someday I will recognize the blue jay for the time that it goes off. I think it goes off at 3 o'clock. Trust the learning capacity. And once we cultivate that sense of, I know me, I know how I can bounce back, I know how I can recover, it will happen on its own with time and space providing. Right? So that's safeness. It's only when we develop that sense of internal safeness, ability to sit with our suffering, to be present to it is what I mean by sit with it. To take breaks from it when we can't, right? When it's too much. Only then can a sense of safety happen in a relationship. Now, I don't mean it's all up to you. Sometimes it can't, but at least at that point, you know you've done your part. You have to know you've done your part. Otherwise, we're going to be dragged around by everybody who wants us to do the work for them. Not because they're mean and cruel, but just because that's human nature. So the practice is always coming back to the breath, internal distress, noticing it. When it's escalating too much, do something that's healthy. Go for a walk, go out, work out, read a book, whatever. Whatever is sustaining for you. But always know that there's always one person behind you, beside you, and that's you. That's me. Right? Me for me, by the way. Although you can summon me up anytime you wish.